Well, let's start with whether or not there really is an increase in autism, or are we just increasing the reports of autism?
Well, there's been a great deal of debate about that question, of course, and it seems that there probably are several factors going on. There probably is quite definitely better reporting. Doctors are more sensitized to a diagnosis of autism. People in general are more alert. But at the same time, there have been some very careful studies that have tried to dissect the bits and pieces out, and they conclude that there's probably a real increase in addition to better reporting.
So we, at the very least, we can't rule out the possibility that there is an increase here.
Can't rule it out, yes. There is certainly better reporting, and there is probably a true increase embedded within that improved reporting. That's my best synthesis.
Okay. And you're arguing that what we should really be focusing on here is the link to environmental exposure. Why do you make that argument?
Well, I'll begin by pointing out that there has been some very elegant genetic research done over the past 5 or 10 years that has very successfully identified a number of genes and gene mutations and other genetic factors that are responsible for a certain number of cases of autism. Altogether, these genetic causes are responsible for something like 20 or 25% of cases. Well, that's very important work, and it's very important to know that there are genetic causes. But at the same time, that those findings leave the causation of something like 75% of cases of autism unexplained. We know from other research on toxic chemicals that the developing human brain is very vulnerable to environmental toxins. We know about lead, we know about mercury, we know about PCBs, we know about certain pesticides. And for each of those chemicals, as well as for ethyl alcohol and for secondhand cigarette smoke, we know that if the developing brain is exposed to the chemical early in development, especially in the early months of pregnancy, that the potential is very high for injury to the developing brain. There exist windows of vulnerability in early brain development that are quite unique and that make the developing brain much more sensitive than the brain of an adult to these toxic exposures.
So genetics alone can't explain this. What evidence do we have that environmental exposures might be a cause here?
Well, there's one line of evidence is what I would call indirect evidence. This is the evidence that the developing human brain is exquisitely sensitive to chemicals in the environment, as shown by the examples of lead, mercury, ethyl alcohol. The second line of evidence I would call proof of principle, and this is the finding that there's a short list of chemicals that have been directly found to be linked to autism. One of these is the drug thalidomide, a drug that was used back in the 1950s and 1960s to suppress morning sickness in women in early pregnancy, which it did, but unfortunately had the terrible side effect of producing limb deformities in babies, and many thousands of babies were afflicted at that time before the causal connection was made. It turns out that some of the babies who had the limb deformities also grew up to have autism. And scientists looking at the puzzle realized that if the exposure took place in the 6th or the 7th or the 8th week of pregnancy, back in the first trimester, there was a high risk of autism in the baby. Since that time, there have been a couple of other drugs, valproic acid, which is an anti-seizure medication, misoprostol. Again, in both of those cases, if the exposure takes place in early pregnancy, there's an elevated risk of autism in the offspring. Now, none of those drugs is in wide use in this country today, so I'm in no way am I postulating that those particular drugs are responsible for cases of autism in today's children in America. But the fact that early life exposure to these drugs can cause autism in certain children says to me that it's possible, that there's a principle involved here, the possibility that other drugs, other environmental chemicals might also be responsible for some cases of autism.
Mm. Also, in this list that you have here of this direct evidence for some environmental causation for autism, you have a pesticide, a pretty commonly used pesticide.
Yes. Well, this is the most recent finding, that a particular pesticide known as chlorpyrifos an organophosphate pesticide, is associated with pervasive developmental disorder, which is a form of autism. And the evidence for this connection comes from epidemiologic studies undertaken in New York City and in California that enrolled pregnant women, took blood and urine samples from those pregnant women during pregnancy to measure levels of chemicals in their blood during pregnancy, and then followed the babies after the babies were born over the next few years, prospectively, longitudinally, to see what conditions developed in the babies. And in those studies, in those prospective studies, links were found between prenatal exposure to chlorpyrifos and the subsequent appearance of this autistic light disorder.
You have this list of eight chemicals that are implicated in neurodevelopmental disabilities, and then remind us that children today might be exposed to some 3,000 synthetic chemicals.
Well, children in today's world are certainly at risk of exposure to synthetic chemicals that simply did not exist 40, 50, or 60 years ago, many, many thousand such chemicals. The Centers for Disease Control does periodic biomonitoring surveys across the United States, which are published on their website. And the most recent of these studies finds that there are more than 100 synthetic chemicals measurable in the bodies of virtually all Americans. So we know that pregnant women, we know that children are being exposed to these chemicals. The real problem is that we don't know the potential toxicity of 80% of these high-volume chemicals. In other words, no testing has ever been done to determine whether these chemicals are safe or not. And as a pediatrician, I find this very worrisome that we're allowing children to be exposed to chemicals whose possible hazard is simply not known.
You have a phrase that you use in your paper here, the exquisite vulnerability of the developing human brain. What are we learning about those very early stages of development that gives us some insight into why that is, why that vulnerability exists?
Well, we've learned from sad experience that the developing brain during pregnancy, during the first several years after birth, is much more sensitive to a whole series of toxic chemicals than the brain of an adult. And I think the biological difference is that the developing human brain is just extraordinarily complex. In the early months of pregnancy, it goes from a few cells along the back of the embryo to an organ that consists of millions of cells with billions of very precisely engineered connections between the cells. And the price of this great complexity is great vulnerability. If anything goes awry in the formation of the brain during pregnancy and the further formation of the brain after birth, the result is brain injury. And this brain injury can show up in different ways in different children, probably depending on their genetic susceptibility. Some children will have a little learning disability. Some children may lose some IQ points. Some children may have a shortened attention span or inability to focus. And the children who are most severely affected present with conditions like dyslexia or attention deficit disorder or possibly even autism.
And you're talking very early in the development. So a pregnant mother at some of these stages wouldn't even know she's pregnant.
That's a real issue, and it's with that in mind that we've increasingly been counseling pregnant women to avoid the environmental hazards that they can reasonably avoid, starting even before they conceive a pregnancy, if they know they're going to be conceiving a pregnancy. For example, urging women to stay well away from any lead paint, to not eat fish that might be high in pesticides or mercury or PCBs, to minimize pesticide use around the home, to avoid cosmetics containing phthalates. All of these are reasonable steps. Websites exist that can guide people in fulfilling each of them.
Part of your recommendations here, then, are for things that individual actions that people can take.
Individual actions, which in some cases, like avoiding lead and avoiding mercury, are based on hard science. Recommendations that in other cases, such as avoiding phthalates, are based on emerging science coupled with the principle of prudent avoidance.
But the bulk of your recommendations here are about how we might actually get to the bottom of this.
Well, yes. One of the things that I call for in the paper is an expanded research agenda that seeks very deliberately to find the chemical causes that I postulate exist for autism. And the reason I make this call is my belief, which is based on years of experience in this field, that if we can identify specific environmental causes of a disorder such as autism, then we can take steps to minimize exposure. We did that very successfully by getting lead out of gasoline. That was an action that reduced blood lead levels in this country by 90% and prevented millions of cases of childhood lead poisoning. We've done it by getting some of the most toxic pesticides off the market, and we did it back in the 1970s when we made the decision to ban the production of PCBs in this country.
So if we're going to have policy directed at attacking the problem of autism, first, we need to have this better information to guide it.
We need better toxicologic information, which translates to better test information on chemicals, and we need strong epidemiologic studies, such as the National Children's Study.
But this is not just a blanket, gosh, we need more study kind of statement. You have a very directed approach here.
Yes, I think I do. And the chemicals that I would put at the top of my list of suspicion are chemicals that fulfill two criteria. Number one, they're widely distributed in children's environments or the environments of pregnant women. And number two, they're chemicals where we already have some suspicion from experimental studies or from studies in adult workers exposed occupationally that these chemicals are neurotoxic.
There's a lot of attention right now on reforming toxic chemical regulation and on increasing scrutiny of certain chemicals of concern. What evidence are you seeing that people are taking autism into account when they do these things?
Well, I think people are beginning to connect the dots and realizing that there exists at least the potentiality, at least the possibility, that certain untested chemicals that are in children's environments may be contributing to neurobehavioral problems in children, and the possibility exists that autism is among those.
You know, in a way, this is pretty scary because the upshot of what you're suggesting here is that there are exposures that in many cases may be well beyond our control that may determine whether or not our child is autistic. But on the other hand, it also implies we can figure this out and do something about it.
Yes. At the end of the day, I think the message here is fundamentally optimistic, that I strongly believe that for 500 years, knowledge has guided medicine, evidence has guided prevention, and time and again we have shown as a society that when we understand the causes of disease, we can take action to prevent it. Lead poisoning is an example. We've reduced lead poisoning in this country by more than 90%. Another great example is what we've done over the last 50 years to reduce rates of heart disease in this country. Beginning back in 1948, the United States Public Health Service launched a landmark study called the Framingham Heart Study in Framingham, Massachusetts. The goal of the Framingham study was to identify the risk factors for heart disease and stroke. It was launched in 1948 because rates of heart disease and stroke were skyrocketing at that time. And within just a few years, the Framingham study identified all the factors that we now understand as the risks for heart disease, which include cigarette smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, sedentary lifestyle, diabetes, and the rest of it. And acting upon that information, we have succeeded in this country in reducing rates of heart disease and stroke by more than 60%. It's an amazing triumph of preventive medicine. I'm in hope that if we can work through big studies like the National Children's Study, discover the preventable causes of diseases like autism in our children, that we can effect a similar revolution in pediatrics in the 21st century.
We should also talk about the focus on vaccines. There was so much attention to vaccines as a possible link to autism. How has that affected the overall field of looking for a real possible cause here?
The question of the possible link between vaccines and autism is clearly a question that needed to be addressed. And approximately a dozen high-quality studies were launched. It turns out now that not one of them has found any epidemiological connection between vaccines and autism.
There have been a number of studies that point to the possibility of environmental exposure. What are you adding here? What's new in your work?
What I'm adding, I think, is that I would like to see some redirection of autism research in this country. Over the past decade, there has been a very substantial investment in genetic research into the causes of autism. And this research has been very fruitful. It's very important. In no way am I disparaging it. But there has been an imbalance between the very substantial research into autism genetics and the much smaller amount of research investment that's been made into environmental causes of autism. And so really what I'm advocating is some redressing of that imbalance.
Why do you think that is, that we've invested so much into the genetic side of this and comparatively little into the environmental exposure side of things?
I think that part of it is a matter of timing. You know, that the concern about autism arose at about the same time as we had succeeded in decoding the human genome, and people have been so entranced, rightfully so, by the promise of the decoding of the genome that they said, well, let's apply these genomic techniques that we've learned to autism and let's see what we can learn. Perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Dr. Philip Landrigan at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome, Jeff. Thank you.